the thing that's been kind of incredible is our capacity to, at the macro level, generate growth to keep this all going. I mean, that's always been the counter argument, right? Is that if we can just grow quickly enough, if we can just, you know, juice the economy enough to get everything going, these problems take care of themselves. You know, we've had this massive financial experiment at the Federal Reserve with quantitative easing. We've had, you know, a decade of low interest rates, you know, to zero and effectively negative when you look at and adjust for inflation. We have record borrowing by families and by corporations and businesses. And we've been running war level deficits at the federal level. And all of this has created, you know, this modest amount of growth. And that's, you know, kept everything going. But in terms of our, you know, our analysis, nothing has really changed.
So this is far afield from where the book is and where your sweet spot is, but it sounds like you're predicting a big crash.
I don't know if it's a crash so much as, you know, it could be, but I think more likely, and this is what I do say in the book, is a steady decline. I mean, I just got back from California a couple of weeks ago. You've got one of the wealthiest per capita states in the United States. You have an epidemic of homelessness. And I'm by epidemic, I mean all along the interstates, the interchanges, all around City Hall, the parks, they're full of homeless encampments. It's a huge dichotomy that we can step back and say unemployment is low, the economy is growing. Yet, I mean, we have Hoovervilles essentially sprouting up in every state around the U.S. Housing unaffordability is a problem. And you know, I just see this as something that could be acute in a crash, but is more likely to just be a chronic pain that we either choose to address or not.
Well, what happens in a macro sense when policymakers decide that they can no longer afford to accumulate debt and they let the air out of the balloon?
If we decided that, which I don't know if we ever could decide that. I mean, I don't know as you decide that voluntarily, I guess. If we decided that voluntarily, I think it would be painful. And I think it would have consequences of a reset in a sense. If you can't, I mean, we saw in 2008, people who couldn't roll over their house and get a new loan, essentially keep increasing their levels of debt, crash the housing market. You would see the same thing in a macro sense if we failed to roll over our debt and use, you know, ever increasing levels of debt to pay off the old stuff. I think what's coming into vogue right now at the macro level are things like debt jubilees, modern monetary theory, a Main Street quantitative easing. So instead of giving money to banks, give it to individuals and small businesses. I think that there has to be a reckoning at some point with the debt overhang. And I doubt that not paying it or letting it wind down will be the answer that people will choose. I think that one, the rapid pain would be too much, you know.
Well, let's move the conversation a little bit back to where you are in your book, Strong Towns, A Bottom-Up Revolution to Rebuild American Prosperity. What is the implication for municipalities when there's a long-term decline?
I was at a city a couple of weeks ago, and there was a presentation they were doing where they had their outlays. So here's all these capital projects we want to do, and it was over a couple of decades, billions of dollars. And they had like two dozen slides going through all their plans, all the things they were going to do. And then they got to the end and they had one slide about their revenue projections, which were in the, you know, millions of dollars, nowhere near what they would need. The assumption being that there are going to be partners at the state level, at the federal level, that will essentially come in and make up that gap, fill that difference. And I think that's the big reckoning cities are going to ultimately experience, is that their stability is premised, the way they're constructed now, on more growth, more projects, more infrastructure, doing more stuff. And that is premised on this partner that we have being a faithful partner, one that will continue to, at ever increasing amounts, not only bail us out from our lack of productivity, but continue to add more and more stuff. If the federal government decides they can't do it, and if the state government comes to reckon with the fact that they can't do it, that pain is going to be most acute at the local government level. In my little city here, I live in Brainerd, Minnesota. It's about 14,000 people. We have more annual debt service than we actually collect in local revenue. So we tax people in the city. And if we taxed people and took all that money, we still wouldn't pay our debt service. Forget paying for police and firefighters and road maintenance and libraries and all that stuff. That is money that comes from other sources, the state and federal government largely. The last time Minnesota got in a budget crisis, and you're in Illinois, so you know, you've experienced this more than we have. The last time we had a budget crisis here, the first thing they cut was aid to local governments. I mean, it's the easiest thing for the state to cut. And so this is a very fragile and tenuous situation that could, at the local government level, go bad in a hurry.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Charles Marone Jr., the author of Strong Towns, A Bottom-Up Revolution to Rebuild American Prosperity. So what should municipalities do about it? They, as you noted, Illinois has had some reshuffling of the tax pie, with the state taking more to address its problems. Municipalities have increasing levels of debt service on their pension obligations that they have neglected over a period of decades. Tax revenues are flat in terms of sales tax. Property taxes in Illinois are high, and municipalities, although they're a relatively low portion of the total property tax pie, have basically said, that's not where we're going to grow revenue. We're going to leave that for the schools. So what are they to do?
Right. The first thing I think is important for cities to understand where they sit today. Cities post-World War II have been made essentially a cog in this macro growth strategy. Cities are the implementation device of a larger growth strategy put forward by the state and federal governments. And so we see cities as, you know, essentially a cog in this machine. That is a voluntary thing. We can, at the local level, in a sense, opt out of that or start opting out of that and start doing things that would make more sense for the community. And I'll give one like crystal example of this. Here in my hometown, we were given 90 cents on the dollar to do a massive infrastructure project to run sewer and water out to our airport at the edge of town. The airport, of course, is federal and state subsidized. We pay a small portion of that, but that's part of a larger, you know, federal project. That itself is tenuous. Every couple of years, they look at cutting small airports like ours. We spend 90 cents, or the state spend 90 cents on the dollar to put this in. It's now ours 100% to maintain. Even the 10% match was a huge dollar amount for us. I mean, it was a couple million dollars. If we instead took our resources and our capacity and focused on our neighborhoods, on places where our people live, where our businesses are starting to operate and trying to operate, and we just focused on how do we deal with the day-to-day struggles people have there, we could spend a fraction of that dollar amount and have projects that paid a huge financial return.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The book is Strong Towns, A Bottom-Up Revolution to Rebuild American Prosperity. The author is Charles Marone Jr. We're talking with him. In the book, you compare Walmart to an inner core building development and look at revenue per acre. And the math works out to drastically favor the city center building as a place to put your incentives. How should cities calculate this? And are they beginning to do that?
Some are starting to do it, but it's a lost art. What you're talking about is financial productivity, literally a third grade math problem. How much value do you get per acre of land that you have?
And that's what you're talking about in terms of the incremental choices that cities make and where to put their neighborhood money.
Exactly. When you look at the Walmart out on the edge of town, I used to, as an engineer, you know, do the infrastructure for these projects. You'll have millions of dollars of infrastructure into a building that produces, you know, $5 million, $6 million of tax base. When you look at the revenue you get from that, it's substantial. It's a big piece of property. It produces a lot of revenue for the city, but it also costs an extreme amount to provide this service to. When you balance those out, it's a financial net loser. When you go to that small little place downtown, even when it's nondescript and seems kind of run down, it might not generate a lot of tax revenue, but it also doesn't cost very much. That one in the book has got like 20 feet of frontage. That's 20 feet of sidewalk, 20 feet of pipe, 20 feet of street, as opposed to the miles that you will have to provide service to the Walmart. And so we are inclined, because we're this cog in this growth machine, to look at the big project as the thing to do. You know, the Walmart brings in, $500,000 or $1 million of revenue a year, and that little place downtown just brings in $4,000 or $5,000. Sure, but you lose money on the Walmart because it costs more to provide the service to, and the one downtown you actually make money on. Just do more of those.
So how should city councils, governing bodies, municipal planners look at neighborhoods to create the conditions incrementally that will make the compact development more robust?
We've put together just a 4-point strategy to do this. And really, it's very simple. It's almost too simple for people to grasp. If we go out, step number one, and look at where people struggle, observe them, and actually, in a biblical sense, like walk a mile in their shoes, right? Like experience the struggles as they experience them. And then second step, figure out what the smallest thing we can do, something literally with paint and duct tape and straw bales and, cones to address that struggle. The third thing is to do it. Just, go out and get it done. It shouldn't take much. It's a little tiny step. And then the fourth step is just to repeat that process over and over. What you see is that cities wind up doing things like street trees and intersection fixes and sidewalk repairs and the small little things that don't cost a lot, but actually have an enormous financial return. Think of it like investing in a stock. You could buy one big blue chip stock and put all your money into that. And that would not, we understand that, like, that would not be very wise.
Well, just wait a second here. Zoning boards and planners love consistency. All of this incremental decision by decision approach threatens a lack of consistency, doesn't it? Isn't there a political will problem here?
I don't think there's a political will problem in the sense that elected and appointed officials tend to grasp this stuff very easily. I do think that what there is a bureaucracy problem. By creating cities to be the implementation arms of these macro policies, we've created a lot of bureaucratic systems that orient up the government food chain. You go to City Hall and people are very versed on the programs at the state government, the programs at the federal government, capital flows from Wall Street through development, different funds, different tax subsidies. What they're not versed on is actually the struggles of people living in their communities. When you talk to elected people, they'll say, like, that's what I came here to do. I came here to work on the pain that people in my neighborhood are feeling. And when I get to City Hall, I'm bombarded with, this federal project or this initiative. So I don't think the problem is so much political as it is bureaucratic. How do we reorient our technical staff to help elected officials address the actual problems in the community?
Are your ideas penetrating that professional class?
Yes, although, I don't think that's where the greatest change will be. We invite those people into our conversation, and I love them, and I'm one of them, so I deeply understand them. But I think that what we're going to need to see first is a robust group of local leaders who are just asking for something different. The technical people can't lead on this. And the elected officials need to know what to ask. And that's the bridge that we're trying to, create right now, is to give people the confidence to understand when your engineer comes to you with this, capital outlay of billions of dollars and then says, we only have millions to do it. Instead of just nodding and going, wow, that's a big financial problem, Ask a different set of questions. You know, why are we doing it this way?
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Charles Marone Jr., the author of Strong Towns, A Bottom-Up Revolution to Rebuild American Prosperity. Let's talk about what this might look like. You mentioned in the book the 15-minute neighborhood. How do you accomplish that? And what is it?
The 15-minute neighborhood is really a concept about how you go about your day. The automobile is an amazing invention, and we all benefit from it. But like with anything, you can take it too far. And if you take it to the point where everything you do requires an automobile trip, all of a sudden the automobile becomes this, you know, chain around your neck instead of something that's a helpful tool. So the idea of a 15-minute neighborhood is to say, how many things that you do in a typical day can we start to put back in your neighborhood so that you have options? Sure, you can drive to the grocery store out on the edge of town, but maybe you could just walk three blocks and get the same stuff. And that three-block walk and people doing it would create all kinds of economic opportunity that really is the strong and resilient type. So what we're talking about is getting back to a more traditional neighborhood design, one where you can live in a place and choose to drive, but you're not forced to drive. One where you can walk if that's an option, but you're not forced to walk. One where you can get things locally if you want, and that is a viable option, but you wouldn't be forced to. And that's a good way to frame, I think, the way we should be thinking about neighborhoods today.
As a society, we're fairly habituated to driving, though, and that hasn't changed even with the fluctuation in fuel prices.
Yeah, although, you know, I think that that's true in a certain economic realm. I walk a lot here. I primarily get around by walking in my town. I can drive. I have the ability. I have a car. I have the money to do it. But the amazing thing is when I walk, I run into all kinds of people who don't have a car, who are making their way through this landscape that we have that's really inhospitable to walking. And they're doing it out of necessity. You know, in January and February, when it's 10 below, 20 below, they'll walk here.
And you're in Brainerd, northern Minnesota.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So the thing is, when we create a city where people can drive but are not forced to drive, what we do is we give people on the margins not only a better life, but we give those people that are just hanging on the capacity to, say, go from two cars down to one car. If you can take someone and give them the capacity to go from two cars to one car, you really don't change their mobility. I mean, they can still get places. But what you do is you massively change their economics. You free up the equivalent of a $115,000 mortgage payment. A mortgage payment on a $115,000 home, you free that up for them to do something else. And that for families that are struggling is a big game changer.
The 15-minute neighborhood includes clusters of businesses with residential, with other assets in the community. Let's talk about the business clusters, though. A bunch of small business. Is this possible in this era of internet sales where most small businesses are suffering because of the ability to get it mailed to you?
It's interesting because in a lot of places we've seen a small business renaissance as Amazon has come about. I think the biggest competitor of Amazon or the biggest industry threatened by Amazon is not the small business. It's the big box stores. And in a sense, if you are a Main Street advocate, Amazon is a double-edged sword because the enemy of my enemy can sometimes be my friend. Amazon is threatening and really crippling the big box stores in many ways. Amazon also, in a way, allows people to live an urban lifestyle, one where you're not dependent on the big box stores. But still be able to, you know, in a sense, enjoy the same kind of lifestyle. I get my deodorant and shampoo and toothpaste delivered by Amazon. I also walk to the local bakery and the local shops. They don't carry that stuff here, and they really couldn't carry it profitably. You know, maybe in a niche like a bodega or something like that if you needed something quickly. But they are not going to be able to do that profitably at scale. But there's a lot of other things, supplemental things that you can do here as a small business that require that personal touch, require that service, are maybe a little bit more value added kind of product that Amazon can't do, that I think we're now creating a niche for if we allow people to, like we said, live in a 15-minute neighborhood and go from two cars down to one or from one car down to zero.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The book is Strong Towns, A Bottom-Up Revolution to Rebuild American Prosperity. The author is Charles Maroon Jr. We're talking with him. You mentioned a couple different examples of risk management. In Peruvian farmers' situations, they spend a lot of time walking from plot to plot to plot that they own, which are scattered. And in the old English commons, farmers, yeoman farmers, also tended to farm disparate plots on the common field. And in so doing, they would avoid having a likelihood that all of their stuff would be wiped out in adverse weather and that they would starve. Apply this to what you're talking about for city redevelopments, would you?
Yeah, absolutely. It's really a trade-off between efficiency and resiliency. I think of my grandfather who grew up during the Great Depression, and he was one of these guys who saved and you know, was a little bit of a pack rat at times, but had that Depression era mentality where, like, you know, I don't know if next month, next year, whenever, I'm going to need something. And, you know, the marginal cost of sacrifice now to save is going to be worth way, way more when I actually figure out that I need it. The strategy of the Peruvian peasants and the old English farmers was, if we've got multiple places where we're farming, if one or two of them get wiped out, or even if six of them get wiped out, we'll still have a seventh and we're not going to starve. I think we're at the point now at the local level, at the community level, especially with the decline that we're seeing across many, many places in Illinois, here in Minnesota, and really all across the U.S., that we have to, at the local level, start talking about what does it mean to be fragile. You know, in 2008, Nancy Pelosi, George Bush, and a whole cadre of officials came to us and said, if we don't spend $1 trillion in the next 48 hours, there will not be food on the grocery store shelves in 3 days. The idea that that was a possibility in our economy, let alone something that could, you know, could actually happen, not just a remote possibility, but that we confronted, that should have been a huge wake-up call for us. You know, what kind of places are we building? That trade-off between efficiency, one where we take all the slack out of the system, where we make things very, very efficient, has a trade-off. And the trade-off is you become more fragile to things outside your control. If we want our places to be strong and resilient, if we want our places to work for us, we've got to give up a little bit of that efficiency and focus on things that make our cities have some of that built-in resiliency and redundancy for us.
After crisis, complacency has arguably set in. How much more difficult is it to sustain attention on an issue when we're talking about a long, slow decline rather than a crisis? How should municipalities prepare to have this conversation, in other words?
Well, you and I are talking amidst this circus of impeachment. And, you know, I think what we see is that conversations like this, the air sucked out of the room, and they're hard to have because they're not the urgent thing in front of us. I think the way to make it urgent is to actually get out and experience the community the way people are living. I mentioned California earlier. We could talk of the same thing throughout Chicago and Illinois. I mean, the homelessness crisis is very real, and it is a byproduct of this decline. It's a byproduct of this kind of messed up relationship between the macroeconomics and what real lived experiences are. I think that if you want to make this an urgency, you need to, in a sense, intentionally opt out of the big circus that's drawing our attention away and just go out and actually experience the struggles that people have in the community. It becomes very real and very urgent for you quickly when you do that.
Charles Marone Jr. is president and co-founder of Strong Towns, a nationally recognized nonprofit media organization working to shape the conversation on growth, development, and the future of cities. He's also a certified professional engineer and has experience as a land use planner. He's the author of Strong Towns, a bottom-up revolution to rebuild American prosperity. Thanks so much for joining us.
Charlie, it's great to talk to you again. Thanks.
I'm Charlie Schlenker.